This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love. This is the author, Danny Shapiro. This book is for my father. Author's note. This is a work of nonfiction. In some cases, names and identifying details have been changed in order to respect and protect the privacy of others, and to keep a promise I made from the very start. I shall never get you put together entirely, pieced, glued, and properly jointed. Sylvia Plath, The Colossus. If you want to keep a secret, you must also hide it from yourself. George Orwell, 1984. Part 1. Chapter 1. When I was a girl, I would sneak down the hall late at night once my parents were asleep. I would lock myself in the bathroom, climb onto the formica counter, and get as close as possible to the mirror until I was nose to nose with my own reflection. This wasn't an exercise in the simple self-absorption of childhood. The stakes felt high. Who knows how long I kneeled there, staring into my own eyes. I was looking for something I couldn't possibly have articulated, but I always knew it when I saw it. If I waited long enough, my face would begin to morph. I was 8, 10, 13. Cheeks, eyes, chin, and forehead, my features softened and shape-shifted until finally I was able to see another face, a different face. What seemed to me a truer face, just beneath my own. Now it is early morning, and I'm in a small hotel bathroom 3,000 miles from home. I'm 54 years old, and it's a long time since I was that girl. But here I am again, staring and staring at my reflection. A stranger stares back at me. The coordinates. I'm in San Francisco, Japantown to be precise. Just off a long flight. The facts. I'm a woman, a wife, a mother, a writer, a teacher. I'm a daughter. I blink. The stranger in the mirror blinks too. A daughter. Over the course of a single day and night, the familiar has vanished. Familiar, belonging to a family. On the other side of the thin wall, I hear my husband crack open a newspaper. The floor seems to sway, or perhaps it's my body trembling. I don't know what a nervous breakdown would feel like, but I wonder if I'm having one. I trace my fingers across the planes of my cheekbones, down my neck, across my clavicle, as if to be certain I still exist. I'm hit by a wave of dizziness and grip the bathroom counter. In the weeks and months to come, I will become well acquainted with this sensation. It will come over me on street corners and curbs, in airports, train stations. I'll take it as a sign to slow down, take a breath, feel the fact of my own body. You're still you, I tell myself, again and again and again. Chapter 2. 24 hours earlier, I was in my home office, trying to get organized for a trip to the West Coast, when I heard Michael's feet pounding up the stairs. It was 10:30 in the evening, and we had to leave before dawn to get to the Hartford Airport for an early flight. I had made a packing list. I'm a list maker, and there were a million things to do. Bras, panties, jean skirt, striped top, sweater, jacket, check weather in SF. I was good at reading the sound of my husband's footsteps. These sounded urgent, though I couldn't tell whether they were good urgent or bad urgent. Whatever it was, we didn't have time for it. Skin stuff, brush, comb, headphones. He burst through my office door, open laptop in hand. Susie sent her results, he said. Susie was my much older half-sister, my father's daughter from an early marriage. We weren't close and hadn't spoken in a couple of years. But I had recently written to ask if she had ever done genetic testing. It was the kind of thing I had never even considered, but I had recalled Susie once mentioning that she wanted to know if she was at risk for any hereditary diseases. A New York City psychoanalyst, she had always been on the cutting edge of all things medical. My email had reached her at the TED conference in Banff. She had written back right away that she had indeed done genetic testing and would look to see if she had her results with her on her computer. Our father had died in a car accident many years earlier, when I was 23 and Susie 38. Through him, we were part of a large Orthodox Jewish clan. It was a family history I was proud of and I loved. Our grandfather had been a founder of Lincoln Square Synagogue, one of the country's most respected Orthodox institutions. Our uncle had been president of the Orthodox Union. Our grandparents had been pillars of the observant Jewish community, both in America and in Israel. Though as a grown woman I was not remotely religious, I had a powerful, nearly romantic sense of my family and its past. The previous winter, Michael had become curious about his own origins. He knew far less about the generations preceding him than I did about mine. His mother had Alzheimer's and had recently fallen and broken her hip. The combination of her injury and memory loss had precipitated a steep and rapid decline. His father was frail but mentally sharp. Michael's sudden interest in genealogy was surprising to me, but I understood it. He was hoping to learn more about his ancestral roots while his dad was still around. Perhaps he'd even enlarge his sense of family by connecting to third or fourth cousins. "Do you want to do it too?" he might have asked. "I'm sending away for a kit. It's only, like, $100. Though I no longer remember the exact moment, it is, in fact, the small, the undramatic, the banal, the yeah, sure, that could just as easily have been a shrug and a no thanks. The kits arrived and sat on our kitchen counter for days, perhaps weeks, unopened. They became part of the scenery, like the books and magazines that pile up until we cart them off to our local library. We made coffee in the mornings, poured juice, scrambled eggs. We ate dinner at the kitchen table. We fed the dog, wrote notes and grocery shopping lists on the blackboard. We sorted mail, took out the recycling. All the while, the kits remained sealed in their green and white boxes, decorated with a whimsical line drawing of a three-leaf clover. Ancestry, the DNA test that tells a more complete story of you. Finally, one night, Michael opened the two packages and handed me a small plastic vial. "Spit," he said. I felt vaguely ridiculous and undignified as I bent over the vial. Why was I even doing this? I idly wondered if my results would be affected by the lamb chops I had just eaten, or the glass of wine, or residue from my lipstick. Once I had reached the line demarking the proper amount of saliva, I went back to clearing the dinner dishes. Michael wrapped a label around each of our vials and placed them in the packaging sent by Ancestry.com. 2 months passed, and I gave little thought to my DNA test. I was deep into revisions of my new book. Our son had just begun looking at colleges. Michael was working on a film project. I had all but forgotten about it until, one day, an email containing my results appeared. We were puzzled by some of the findings. I say puzzled, a gentle word, because this is how it felt to me. According to Ancestry, my DNA was 52% Eastern European Ashkenazi. The rest was a smattering of French, Irish, English, and German. Odd, but I had nothing to compare it with. I wasn't disturbed. I wasn't confused, even though that percentage seemed very low, considering that all my ancestors were Jews from Eastern Europe. I put the results aside and figured there must be a reasonable explanation, tied up in migrations and conflicts many generations before me. Such was my certainty that I knew exactly where I came from. In a cabinet beneath our television, I keep several copies of a documentary about pre-war shtetl life in Poland called Image Before My Eyes. The film includes archival footage taken by my grandfather during a 1931 visit to Harodok, the family village. By then the owner of a successful fabric mill, He brought my great-grandfather with him. The film is all the more powerful for the present-day viewers' knowledge of what will soon befall the men with their double beards, the women in modest black, the children crowding the American visitors. Someone, my grandfather, holds the shaky camera as the doomed villagers dance around him in a widening circle. Then we cut to a quieter moment. In grainy black and white, my grandfather and great-grandfather pray at the grave of my great-great-grandfather. I can almost make out the cadence of their voices, voices I have never heard, but that are the music of my bones, as they recite the mourner's Kaddish. My grandfather wipes tears from his eyes. In the year before my son's bar mitzvah, I played him that part of the documentary. Do you see? I paused on the image of the rough old stone carved in Hebrew. This is where we come from. That's the spot where your great-great-great-grandfather is buried. It felt urgently important to me to make Jacob aware of his ancestral lineage, the patch of earth from which he sprang. The source of a spirit passed down, a connection. Of course, that tombstone would have been plowed under just a few years later. But in that moment, my people, captured for all time, I was linking them to my own boy and him to them. He hadn't known my father, but at least I was able to give Jacob something formative that I myself had grown up with, a sense of grounding in coming from this family. He is the only child of an only child, but this was a vast and abundant part of his heritage that could never be taken away from him. We watched as the men on the screen swayed back and forth in a familiar rhythm, a dance I have known all my life. So that 52% breakdown was just kind of weird, that's all, as bland and innocuous as those sealed green and white boxes had been. I thought I'd clear it up by comparing my DNA results with Susie's. Now, on the eve of our trip to the West Coast, Michael was sitting next to me on the small, tapestry-covered chaise in the corner of my office. I felt his leg pressed against mine as side by side we looked down at his laptop screen. Later, he will tell me he already knew what I couldn't allow myself even to begin to consider. On the wall directly behind us hung a black and white portrait of my paternal grandmother, her hair parted in the center, pulled back tightly, her gaze direct and serene. Comparing Kit M440247 and A765211. Largest segment equals 14.9 centimorgans. Total of segments, greater than 7 centimorgans equals 29.6 centimorgans. Estimated number of generations to MRCA equals 4.5. 653629 SNPs used for this comparison. Comparison took 0.04538 seconds. What does it mean? My voice sounded strange to my own ears. You're not sisters. Not half-sisters? No kind of sisters. How do you know? Michael traced the line estimating the number of generations to our most recent common ancestor. Here. The numbers, symbols, unfamiliar terms on the screen were a language I didn't understand. It had taken 0.04538 seconds, a fraction of a second, to upend my life. There would now forever be a before. The innocence of a packing list. The preparation for a simple trip. The portrait of my grandmother in its gilded frame. My mind began to spin with calculations. If Susie was not my half-sister, no kind of sister, it could mean only one of two things. Either my father was not her father, or my father was not my father. Chapter 3. A sepia photograph of my father as a little boy hangs just outside our living room, where I pass it dozens of times a day. He poses in a herringbone coat and bowler hat, white knee socks and shoes, playfully holding a cane. His eyes are round, his smile impish. He was the oldest son born into a family obsessed with recording itself, a family conscious of its own legacy. Grandparents, great-uncles, great-aunts, even distant cousins from the old country are scattered throughout my house. But it is the portrait of my father that is my favorite. "Who's that?" friends will ask. "My dad," I will answer. He has been dead more than half my life, and still the feeling is the same. A warm, quiet pride, a sense of connection, of tethering, of belonging. The portraits and sepia photographs can be traced to the Eastern Europe of my forebears. My 93-year-old Aunt Shirley, my father's younger sister, has been the family archivist. Years ago, she entrusted Michael and me with the task of digitizing the contents of a massive leather-bound family album. Jagged-edged photographs traced an evolution from the dusty shtetl to prosperous turn-of-the-century America. Michael took each one from the album and created an online version to share with the grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren, now numbering in the hundreds. There's Grammy and Grampy about to set sail for Europe. My grandparents were regal and glamorous next to a trolley piled high with their steamer trunks. There's Rabbi Soloveitchik and Uncle Mo with Lyndon Johnson. There's Mo with John Kennedy. Men in yarmulkes, next to presidents, their faces proud and lit with purpose. These ancestors are the foundation upon which I have built my life. I have dreamt of them, wrestled with them, longed for them. I have tried to understand them. In my writing, they have been my territory, my obsession, you might even say. They are the tangled roots, thick, rich, and dark, that bind me to the turning earth. During younger years when I was lost, particularly after my dad's death, I used them as my inner compass. I would ask what to do, which way to turn. I would listen intently and hear them answer. I don't mean this metaphysically, not exactly. I'm not sure what I believe about where we go when we die, but I can say with certainty that I've felt the presence of this long-gone crowd whenever I've sought them. My dad in particular would come to me in an electric tingle running the length of my body. I was convinced that my father was able to reach me through time and space because of the thousands of people who connected us. L'dor v'ador. These Hebrew words, one of the most fundamental tenets of Judaism, translate into from generation to generation. I am the 10th and youngest grandchild of Joseph Shapiro, self-made industrialist, philanthropist, a leader of modern orthodoxy, chairman of the Presidium of the Masifta Tiferet Jerusalem, treasurer of Torah Umasora, vice president of the Lubavitcher Yeshiva, member of the national board of the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations. I am the 10th and youngest grandchild of Beatrice Shapiro, his beautiful, gracious wife, who was admired and emulated by religious women of her generation the world over. I am the daughter of their oldest son, Paul. Everything I am, everything I know to be true, begins with these facts. I woke up one morning and life was as I had always known it to be. There were certain things I thought I could count on. I looked at my hand, for example, and I knew it was my hand. My foot was my foot. My face, my face. My history, my history. After all, it's impossible to know the future, but we can be reasonably sure about the past. By the time I went to bed that night, my entire history, the life I had lived, had crumbled beneath me like the buried ruins of an ancient, forgotten city. A Zen meditation made popular by the 20th century Indian sage Ramana Maharshi goes like this. The student begins by asking and answering the question, "Who am I?" "I am a woman. I am a mother. I am a wife. I am a writer. I am a daughter. I am a granddaughter. I am a niece. I am a cousin. I am, I am, I am." The idea is that eventually the sense of I am will dissolve. Once we're past all our many labels and notions of what makes us who we think we are, we will discover that there is no I, no us. This will lead us to a greater understanding of the true nature of impermanence. The exercise is meant to go on long past the most obvious pillars of our identity, the ones beyond question, until we run out of all the ways we think of ourselves. But what does it mean when the I am breaks down at the very beginning of the list? Chapter 4. There are many varieties of shock. This is something you don't know until you've experienced a few of them. I've been on the other end of a phone call hearing the news that my parents were in a car crash and both might not live. I've sat in a doctor's office being told that my baby boy had a rare and often fatal disease. I have felt the slam, the blade, the breathless falling, a physical sense of being shoved backward into an abyss. But this was something altogether different. An air of unreality settled like a cloak around me. I was stupid, disbelieving. The air became thick sludge. Nothing computed. Maybe they got it wrong. Michael just looked at me. Switched vials? Mislabeled the results? It was the thinnest of threads, but it was all I had. Human error. It seemed possible in that moment that all of this would turn out to be a big mistake, something that would become a crazy story I'd tell someday after I'd recovered from this needless distress. Let me see if I can get someone on the phone, Michael said. He paused in the door to my office. You okay? I'm fine. My voice was reedy, stretched taut. Alone in my office, I went back to ordinary things with a vengeance. I unplugged my phone charger from the wall and wrapped the wires neatly around it. I packed up my travel-sized toiletries and checked them off the list. I looked up the San Francisco weather and folded an extra sweater into my bag. Estimated number of generations to MRCA equals 4.5. Susie and I were 4.5 generations away from a most recent common ancestor. At first, this didn't seem like a lot of generations, but within a single ethnic group like Eastern European Ashkenazi Jews, by 4.5 generations, just about everyone has an ancestor in common. Close relatives, parents, uncles, aunts, first, second, even third and fourth cousins, are pinpointed by DNA testing sites with a degree of precision. If two people share a father, the results would be resoundingly clear. Susie and I were not related. Somewhere within me, in a place as dangerous and electric as a live wire, I knew what this meant, if it was true. If it was true, being something that I would repeat to myself again and again. If it was true, being something that I might always cling to in a disbelieving, childlike way, part of the thick sludge. If it was true that Susie and I were not half-sisters, my father was not my father. That he was Susie's father was without question. She looked like him. She had his eyes and the shape of his face. She even sounded a bit like him, her cadences those of a born and bred yeshiva-educated New Yorker. I, on the other hand, looked nothing like my father or like anyone in his family. I was pale-skinned, very blonde, blue-eyed. All my life, I'd fielded and deflected comments about not looking Jewish. But I had no reason to question my biological connection to my dad. He was my dad. But now, in a minefield of doubt, there was no doubt in my mind about Susie's paternity. Only about mine. The more chaotic my thoughts became, the more precise my actions, as if carefully folded t-shirts and jeans might fix everything. I could hear Michael's voice downstairs. Had he gotten someone on the phone at this hour? Where was Ancestry.com even located? I imagined a massive warehouse full of thousands of plastic vials. I was trying to think it all through, but with a mind blunted as if by a sledgehammer blow. Vladimir Nabokov, in Speak Memory, ponders the question of how to examine a deluded mind when one's only resource is a deluded mind. I picked my way through the little I knew. First of all, that business about being 52% Eastern European Ashkenazi in the DNA analysis. That was ridiculous. Of course I was entirely Jewish. My parents were both Jewish. I had been raised Orthodox. I mean, I was very Jewish. I spoke fluent Hebrew until I was in high school. I had always countered the litany of questions about my ethnicity with a recital of my impeccable family history. That plastic vial must have been accidentally switched with that of some half-Jewish person who was, at this very moment, confused about her own DNA. My results had also listed a first cousin who was unfamiliar to me. There he was, a blue icon, like one that might be found on the door to a men's room, identified only by his initials. This, Michael will later tell me, set off loud, clanging warning bells for him. But not for me. Obviously, I knew all my first cousins. This only reinforced my certainty that there must be some mistake. I ran through the facts of my own identity again and again, as if memorizing a poem or factors of an equation. By the time Michael came back upstairs, it was nearly midnight. We were leaving for the airport in 4 hours. I was freezing. He wrapped his arms around me, but not before I saw the look on his face. I registered that I had never seen him look at me that way before. Not when my mother died, not when our boy was sick. I would describe it as something bordering on pity. It wasn't so much my future that was being irrevocably altered by this discovery. It was my past. Michael had already known this, of course, well before he looked up the toll-free number on Ancestry's website. He had known when he first saw the surprising breakdown of my ethnicity, when a cousin, who was a stranger, had appeared along with my results like an emissary from some foreign world. "It's not a mistake," he said softly. In the ensuing weeks, every person I tell about this night will say a version of the same thing. "Must be a mix-up. It can't be true." They will say it protectively, indignantly. They will say it out of kindness. And they will be wrong. Millions of people have had their DNA tested by Ancestry.com, and no such mistake has ever been made. Chapter 5. In the immediate aftermath of my discovery, there was one incident, one story, that crystallized in my mind. It was 1988. I was 25 years old, and my father had been dead exactly 2 years. My mother had been badly injured in the car accident that killed my father, and I had spent the previous 2 years taking care of her. At the same time, I was in graduate school at Sarah Lawrence, and I was writing my first novel as if my life depended on it, which in a way it did. Writing was my way of trying to give shape to my sorrow. I was alternately numb and filled with searing pain. These seemed my only two states of being. I cut off all my hair, broke up with my boyfriend, quit smoking, quit drinking. All my free time was devoted to reading the poems of Adrienne Rich. I wondered if maybe I was a lesbian. I was a stranger to myself, adrift in the world. I didn't want my mother to spend the second anniversary of my dad's death alone. I invited her to come with me to school, where some of the graduate students were giving readings. I picked her up in her apartment on West End Avenue, and we drove the half hour north together. I didn't have much to say to my mother. I never really had. Our life, as mother and daughter, had been fraught and contentious, devoid of the easy love I felt for my father. As a child, I'd had the fantasy, a form of hope, now a staggering irony, that she wasn't actually my mother. The silence between us was less companionable than tense and awkward. But we had entered strange new territory since the accident. She had recovered from her injuries far beyond her doctor's expectations. Still, she was frail and walked with a cane. Her face had been smashed to bits, but now it was reassembled, her nose slightly askew, one eye a different shape from the other. As she often reminded me, I was all she had. Before the reading, the students and faculty gathered for a reception in the living room of the house on campus, where each of us would soon read from our manuscripts. It was at this reception that I introduced my mother to one of my classmates named Rachel. "Rachel, where are you from?" my mother asked. "Philadelphia," Rachel replied. "Oh, my daughter was conceived in Philadelphia." Smooth, without missing a beat. In 25 years, I had never heard this. I pictured a hotel, a romantic weekend getaway. But my mother had already moved on to extol the virtues of the city of brotherly love. What do you mean I was conceived in Philadelphia? I asked. Oh, you don't want to know, my mother replied. It's not a pretty story. That night, after the earnest readings, the styrofoam cups of herbal tea, paper plates piled with cookies, I drove my mother down the Sawmill River Parkway in the winter darkness. 2 years earlier, with my mother in critical condition in a New Jersey hospital, I had buried my father in the Shapiro family plot in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. It had been my first funeral. My father's sister, brother, all my cousins, even Susie, seemed to know exactly what to do. The Stark service was conducted entirely in Hebrew. One of my cousins, a rabbi, led the service. The rituals of mourning were foreign to me. Though I had been raised Orthodox, there were striations of Orthodoxy. And at my own father's funeral, I felt like an interloper, out of place amidst my family. "Here's where you walk," one of my cousins guided me. "Here's a shovel," another one said. "Now it's time to wash your hands." "Mom?" "Yes, dear." "Mom, you can't just say something like that about my conception. You need to tell me what you meant." Both our eyes were trained straight ahead, the car a confessional, a vault. "There was a doctor, an institute, in Philadelphia," my mother said. "Your father and I were having trouble conceiving." She stopped there. We were 20 minutes from her apartment. "He had slow sperm," she added. And then, after another beat, "I'd had several miscarriages, and I was in my late 30s by then." "So what happened?" "I would go to Philadelphia. This was a world-famous institute, and they would monitor exactly where I was in my cycle. Then, when it was time, I'd call your father on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and he would race down so we could do the procedure." "What procedure?" "Artificial insemination." If I hadn't been driving, I would have closed my eyes. You want the story of your conception to be, at the very least, corporeal. A man and a woman, limbs entwined, sperm swimming to egg. Not the sterile clinic I suddenly envisioned, a test tube, a medical version of a turkey baster. Not my father, alone in a room with pornography and a Dixie cup. "I told you," my mother said. "Not a pretty story." What sharpened my senses that night to such a degree that I would be able to retrieve the conversation in its entirety 30 years later? At the time, I found the whole thing odd, slightly discomforting, but of little consequence. Really, what difference did it make how I had been conceived? I was here. Who cared how my father's sperm got to my mother's egg? Now the details are so clear to me, as if contained in a time capsule. The Hudson River in the darkness, the lights strung across the George Washington Bridge, the even timbre of my mother's voice, the high plane of her cheekbone, her long-fingered hands clasped in her lap. Institute. World famous. Philadelphia. Chapter 6. Bradley Airport near Hartford is a place I know well. A frequent traveler, I have my routine. First stop after going through security is always a small, futuristic-looking glass cylinder where for $2 you can place your eyeglasses inside for a power wash. With satisfyingly clean glasses, my typical pattern is to then proceed to the newsstand to stock up on trashy magazines. After, if time allows, I stop at Lavazza for a mediocre cappuccino to drink at the gate. I find the familiar routine comforting when I travel. It cuts through the usual disorientation I tend to feel when leaving home. But my standard travel anxieties, which had not been insignificant, were, I now realized, nothing compared to this. I walked unsteadily through the wide halls of the airport like a convalescent. Michael stayed close to me as we passed a wall of projected images, part of an interactive ad campaign for travelers' insurance, depicting a series of red umbrellas made of roses that broke apart into hundreds of petals as each person passed by. People of every shape and size disrupted the umbrellas, causing the petals to scatter in different ways. Children were especially taken with the images. They stopped, jumped up and down, windmilled their arms. Tohu vavohu. The Hebrew words, From the second sentence of Genesis, arose in me the way the Hebrew language tended to, like bits of sediment shaken loose from some subterranean place. Tohu vavohu meant chaos, the world upside down. No, the world before it was the world. My body felt strange and weightless. Was I even here? Maybe I didn't exist. My whole life had been a dream I'd dreamt up. As we passed the red umbrellas, I looked to be sure that my shape registered. We reached the gate 45 minutes before boarding. Michael had his computer open on his lap and was typing search terms into Google, looking up fertility clinics in Philadelphia that had existed in the early 1960s. His background as a journalist made this kind of research second nature to him. It took only a few minutes to zero in on the place it had to be. The Farris Institute for Parenthood, he said, on the campus of Penn. Institute, my mother had said, not clinic, not hospital. A few swift keystrokes and we were reading up on Dr. Edmund Farris, a trailblazer. World famous, my mother had said, in the field of infertility and artificial insemination. Another detail my mother had mentioned that night came back to me. The famous doctor had pioneered a method to pinpoint when a woman was ovulating. I'd call your father, and he would race. All around us, the airport hummed with travelers going places. Flights were departing for Atlanta, Detroit, Miami, Chicago. A tired-looking flight attendant walked past, dragging her small bag behind her. The sun had just begun to rise, glowing orange over the tarmac. The words blurred together. Sterility, infertility, insemination. And then another couple of words connected with the Farris Institute for Parenthood. Sperm donor. The term seemed to be sharper than all the rest. Sperm donor. I looked up from Michael's screen and all I saw were men. Young men, old men, very old men. Men holding babies, fat men wearing baseball caps, men in tank tops and track pants, men in button-downs and cardigans. If my father wasn't my father, who was my father? If my father wasn't my father, who was I? That February night, nearly 30 years ago, after dropping my mother off at her apartment, I went home and called Susie. Did you know anything about Dad and Irene having fertility problems? That sounds familiar. I was a teenager, but I knew something was up. I told Susie what my mother had said. Philadelphia, the institute, the famous doctor, the slow sperm, the urgency, her biological clock tick, tick, ticking, our father's mad dash from New York so they could make a baby. Susie paused. And she told you it was definitely Dad's sperm that was used? My hand tightened around the phone. My stomach clenched as it often did around my half-sister. Of course it was Dad's sperm. You might want to look into it, she said. They used to mix sperm in those days. Mix sperm. Once you hear a phrase like that, you never forget it. Two words that crash against each other, like a nonsensical Mad Libs fill-in-the-blank. Susie said it the way she said most things, in a practiced, seemingly casual way, but beneath it was a current of something alive. She was telling me that I should look into the possibility that we were not sisters, that our father was hers, not mine. My psychoanalyst half-sister was expressing a very deep and perhaps not wholly conscious wish. She would have preferred that I had not been born. I remember my own anger and bitter humor. Analyze that, I said to friends. But I did bring it up to my mother the next time we were together. Here is where my memory becomes hazy. We might have been walking the streets of the Upper West Side. She walked a lot in those days to strengthen her legs. Mom, I heard something, going back to what you told me about what happened in Philadelphia. My mother was unreadable to me, not only in that moment, but in every moment. She never let her true self be seen. Her dark eyes often quivered disconcertingly, and when she smiled, it was a careful smile, as if smiling was something she practiced in private. I heard that sometimes they would mix the sperm. I may not remember whether we were on Broadway or West End or Riverside Drive, but I am clear on one thing. There was no ripple, no tensing, no quick blink. Not a glimmer of surprise or distress crossed my mother's face. She exhibited no confusion at the bizarre phrase. "Do you think," she responded, "that your father would ever have agreed to that? It would have meant he wouldn't have known if his child was Jewish." My father's life had been shaped by the rules of observant Judaism. He was a black and white thinker, good, bad, right, wrong. He was also a person who was clear-headed and interested in the truth. Mixing his sperm with those of any stranger would have been unthinkable, but a non-Jewish stranger would have been impossible. I was sure of that. His religion was the deepest and most abiding part of his identity, and Judaism wasn't only a religion, it was an ethnicity. His child would have been other, set apart from the very lineage he came from. "You knew your father," my mother went on. In my memory, she is looking directly at me. "Can you imagine such a thing?" Chapter 7. Throughout history, great philosophical minds have grappled with the nature of identity. What makes a person a person? What combination of memory, history, imagination, experience, subjectivity, genetic substance, and that ineffable thing called the soul makes us who we are? Is who we are the same as who we believe ourselves to be? Philosophers, who love nothing more than to argue with one another, do seem to agree that a continued, uninterrupted sense of self, the indivisible thing which I call myself, is necessarily implied in a consciousness of our own identity. The identity of a person is a perfect identity. Wherever it is real, it admits of no degrees, and it is impossible that a person should be in part the same and in part different, because a person is not divisible into parts. This from early 19th century philosopher Thomas Reid. It might have happened that I discovered the truth of my paternity at a moment when I would be staying, as I often do, at home. I might have sat silent for days on end in my leather chair in my library, surrounded by the thousands of books that make up at least a portion of my consciousness, books that have taught me how to think, how to live. I might have taken my dogs for long, slow walks. I might have treated myself like a post-operative patient, a person who has been carved up and stitched together. With our son on the other side of the country in a summer film program, the house would have been quiet. In late June, the peonies planted along the back of our house had begun to bloom. Instead, we boarded a flight to Minneapolis. You can't get from Hartford to San Francisco directly, at least not on Delta, which is where we have our miles. And so I settled into seat 12A by the window. I pulled my magazines out of my bag and stuffed them into the seat pocket in front of me. A bachelorette was in the midst of a breakup. A Kardashian was in trouble. I leaned my head against Michael's shoulder. I didn't know how to be, what to do next. I saw my dad's face, not as it was when he was at his happiest, but as it appeared in the days after my parents' accident. Gray, his eyes vacant, mouth slack. It seemed the essence of him, the spirit of him, was already gone. He died of his injuries shortly after. And then another image. I'm a young woman meeting my father for lunch on Wall Street. The trading floor doors swing open and out he comes, beaming, alive. He wears a tan jacket, the uniform of all the traders. His head is round and bald. The glasses he always wore are nearly rimless, just a glint of gold at the temples. He smiles the hard-earned smile of a wounded man who lives for pockets of joy and is still able to feel them. He is at his most vital in two places, here where he works, and in synagogue where he prays. He wraps me in a bear hug as the crowd mills around us. I squeezed my eyes shut against hot tears. This felt like a second death. I was losing him all over again. I had become divisible. In part the same, in part different. A fundamental law of identity, my very sense of self, broken open. Something that never occurred to me as I flew across the country, though it would have been reasonable to contemplate, that my mother might have had an affair. But I just didn't go there. I didn't need to. Pieces to an enormous puzzle, the puzzle of my life, in fact, began to click into place with such speed and efficiency that it seemed no other explanation was possible. The flight attendants made their way down the aisle with the beverage cart. They offered pretzels, granola bars, salted peanuts. The two prior times in my life I'd experienced shock and terror, my parents' accident and Jacob's illness, it seemed an impossible affront that people were going about their daily business, and that in fact no one's life had changed but mine and those of people I loved. Here I was again. Except a parent's death, shivering over a child, these were common experiences. You could say, my father died, or my baby's sick, to just about anybody, and they would respond with compassion and understanding. But how about, I just found out that my dad wasn't my biological father and that apparently I come from an anonymous sperm donor. I glanced over at Michael's open computer screen. He booted up GoGo Wi-Fi as soon as we reached 10,000 feet and was on my Ancestry.com page, staring at the small, blue, human-shaped icon, identified only by the initials A.T. My first cousin, a male. Blue for boys. What next? I couldn't imagine what might come next. I am a spinner of narratives, a teller of tales. I have spent my life attempting to make meaning out of random events, to shape stories out of an accretion of senseless, chaotic detail. As a writer and a teacher of writing, this is what I do. What if, I might begin to suggest to a student, how about? But I have been dealing within the confines of a known world. I am not a fantasist. I have never been drawn to mysteries of the whodunit variety or to sci-fi. Magic realism interests me, but there are limits to my suspension of disbelief. What never failed to draw me in, however, are secrets. Secrets within families. Secrets we keep out of shame or self-protectiveness or denial. Secrets and their corrosive power. Secrets we keep from one another in the name of love. Out my window, the sky was a vivid blue, streaked with clouds. Below, the fields of Wisconsin appeared in orderly rectangles, the opposite of tohu vavohu, evidence of coherence. What do you think the profile of a sperm donor would have been in the early 1960s? I asked Michael. In Philadelphia, he said, eyes still trained on his computer screen, the blue icon. On the campus of Penn. What was I asking? Even as I posed the question, the word sounded absurd. The sheer vastness of possibility. Any man of a certain age could be my biological father, slammed into a lifetime of singularity and conviction. I wasn't my father's daughter. The thought knifed through me, sharper each time I touched it. Doctors often donated sperm, Michael said, and medical students. Was my biological father a medical student? It was nothing more than a working theory, but one that felt right to both of us. What did right even mean? How and where did this shared idea come from? I had never paid any attention to the history of reproductive medicine or artificial insemination. Hell, I hadn't even watched Masters of Sex, though I had heard it was pretty good. If I didn't come from my father, who did I come from? A medical student, I said aloud. Michael nodded. Yeah, a med student at the University of Pennsylvania. Chapter 8. The father I knew had always been sad. He wasn't so much a depressive by nature as he was a kind-hearted, cheerful person who had been beaten down by life. He had married young, a marriage arranged by two prominent Orthodox families, and that relationship quickly turned unhappy. When Susie was 6 years old, his first wife left while he was away on a business trip. The story I've been told is that he came home to their empty apartment to find nothing but his clothes hanging in the closet. Divorce was virtually unheard of in the tight-knit community that made up my father's world in the early 1950s. Devastated, he fought for the closest thing to shared custody that existed in those days. He had Susie every Wednesday night and on alternate weekends. A short while into his life as a single father, he fell in love with a young woman named Dorothy. Dorothy was 26 when they met, an alluring, incandescent creature with bright eyes and an easy smile. And in the few photographs I've seen of the two of them together, my father's face is soft, unguarded, and full of joy. They set a wedding date and began to dream of their shared future. But my father had unknowingly become a player in a tragedy. Dorothy had been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a death sentence back then, and her family had kept her condition secret from her. My father discovered the truth a few days before their wedding, and against rabbinic advice, telling no one except his best friend and his sister, moved forward with the plan to marry. Dorothy was, many of those who knew them together have told me, the love of his life. She died 6 months later. I didn't know about Dorothy when I was growing up. I didn't know to what to attribute my father's unhappiness. Evenings, he slumped in his easy chair watching television. He became sedentary and fat, one of many sources of conflict between my parents, and his belly strained over the top of his trousers. When I was 13, his chronic back pain became so extreme that he underwent spinal fusion surgery. He never fully recovered, and he numbed himself with painkillers and sedatives for the rest of his life. It wasn't until I was a grown woman, a writer, when I had reached the age my father had been when he had been divorced, then widowed, that I became obsessed with knowing more of what had happened. I was convinced that the loss of Dorothy must be the primary locus of my father's pain. And so I wrote an article for The New Yorker and painstakingly assembled the crushing details of the brief life he and Dorothy had shared. It felt to me, in the months it took to write that piece, that I was gluing my father back together. This is what I did, what I had always done from the time I first put pen to paper. Tikkun olam. I was trying to repair my broken father, to make him whole. Perhaps, it occurs to me as I write these words, I am attempting to reassemble my father once more. My father met my mother in the aftermath of Dorothy's death. He had moved into an apartment on East 9th Street in New York City, and my mother lived on the same block. She was vivacious, intrepid, an advertising executive recently divorced herself. The first time they encountered each other, on Shabbos, she was carrying a hammer and on her way to install bookcases in her own new apartment. "He should have known," my mother would later say. She wasn't from his world. She was Jewish, but not religious. Otherwise, she wouldn't have been building bookcases on Shabbos. But after months of dating, dazzled by my father and his exceptional family, she agreed to become Orthodox when they married, and to raise their children in an observant home. My father must have been certain that my mother was his last best chance. It took my parents 5 years to have a child. 5 years, punctuated by miscarriages, and trip after trip to Philadelphia. 5 years, in which my mother was approaching 40. In the years my parents were trying and failing to have a baby, my father's younger brother and his wife had 4 children. His younger sister already had 4 children. One of the most important mitzvahs according to Jewish law, pru u'revu, be fruitful and multiply. I thought I understood my father's sorrow. I had written deeply on the subject, not only in The New Yorker, but also in several of my books. Finally, I came to accept that I had learned all I could learn. That he had been unhappy was without question, but at least I had been able to build a monument to him, a stack of stories, essays, memoirs, novels that I wrote in his honor, my own secular form of Kaddish. I knew all about his tyrannical, exacting father, his capricious first wife, the loss of his great love, the bitterness of his marriage to my mother. But there had been something more, something I could never quite fathom. An invisible live wire stretched between my parents and me. Touch it, and we might all go up in smoke. I knew this too, though I couldn't have articulated it. I had turned away from fiction, toward memoir, as if a trail of words might lead me there. All the while I wondered, why did it matter so much? After all, my parents were long dead. I had survived them. I had built a life. I had a family of my own. Whatever their secrets, they were now buried, lost to history. My latest book was the first of my memoirs that had nothing to do with my parents. It turns out that it is possible to live an entire life, even an examined life, to the degree that I had relentlessly examined mine, and still not know the truth of oneself. In the end, it wasn't words, but numbers I stared at disbelievingly on a computer screen that smashed down the door and flooded every corner, every crevasse, with a blinding light. Comparing kit M440247 and A765211. All my life I had known there was a secret. What I hadn't known, the secret was me. Part 2. Chapter 9. A classic children's book I used to read Jacob when he was small is titled, Are You My Mother? In it, a baby bird goes off in search of his mother after he falls from his nest. Since he doesn't know what his mother looks like, his mother could be anyone or anything. Are you my mother? He asks a kitten, a hen, a dog, a cow. Are you my mother? He asks a plane, a steam shovel. The reader roots for the baby bird, of course, as he perches on the nose of a bored dog. Are you my mother? But beneath the most obvious reasons we hope for the baby bird to find his mother is an even more profound one. Unless he finds his mother, he will not know who or what he is. We had a 2-hour layover in Minneapolis, another airport I know well. I left Michael to his breakfast and found a quiet spot at a gate across from the restaurant. I had scribbled down a very brief list of everyone I could think of, friends of my parents, elderly relatives, anyone at all who might still be alive and could possibly know something, anything, about what happened in a fertility clinic in Philadelphia 54 years earlier. There were so few people left. My dad's 93-year-old sister Shirley was one, but I couldn't possibly call her. If my father wasn't my father, then she wasn't my aunt. The thought made me tremble, and I lowered myself into a plastic chair bolted to the floor. Grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins floated away from me like dozens of life rafts. There was only one person I could think of to call, my mother's best friend, who, if still living, would now be in her early 90s. My mother had had very few close friends. Her friendships tended to end in hurt feelings and recriminations. Yet Charlotte, whom she had known since they were college sorority sisters, had remained. I remembered her as kind, sensible, loyal, a temperament that nicely offset my mother's penchant for drama. I tried to steady myself before dialing Charlotte. I hated the phone in the best of circumstances, preferring email, an introverted writer's refuge. Would Charlotte tell me that everyone had always known I wasn't my father's child? I hadn't known the truth of my own being, and that was nearly unendurable. But if I discovered that my identity was an open secret, withheld only from me, how would I survive it? As the phone rang, my heart raced. Maybe she was dead. Maybe she was senile. Maybe she would confirm my worst fears. In which case, I would be left with the terrible awareness that my two dead parents had hidden my very identity from me. I heard my mother's voice. You knew your father. Can you imagine such a thing? My last conversation with Charlotte had been 15 years earlier, when my mother was on her deathbed. Now, after a few stilted pleasantries, she was alive and lucid, I began to stutter out the reason for my call. This was the first, but far from the last time, I would have to tell the story to an old person, a very old person, knowing that it might be painful and challenging. How old was too old for a surprise? How old was too old to blow up the past rather than keep it intact? Charles, did you know that my parents had fertility issues? I waded in slowly. I did. Your mother had quite a few miscarriages. Were you aware that they went to a doctor in Philadelphia? Yes, there were many trips to Philadelphia, Charlotte responded. Your mother desperately wanted a child. So you knew that I was conceived by artificial insemination? Yes, dear, I knew that, yes. There was nothing to do but come out and say it. Charles, I've just found out that my father wasn't my biological father, I said. A second passed, maybe two. I pictured her sitting at the kitchen table in her small New Jersey condo, a mug of coffee by her side. It was still morning, even though Michael and I had already flown halfway across the country. Please, 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 I found myself praying. But for what? And to whom? What are you saying? Her voice shook. That's impossible. Impossible. Suddenly I was able to take a deeper breath. She hadn't known. Did my mother ever say anything? Anything at all that might have even hinted at? Your mother would have told me, Charlotte said. She told me everything. I went on to explain the genetic testing and the stark fact that I was not related to Susie, along with the mystifying appearance of A.T., a first cousin. There must have been a mistake. Maybe they switched the test tubes, she said. As unseemly as it felt to be telling this to a nonagenarian, I described what I knew thus far about the practice of mixing sperm. I was now the conveyor of information rather than the recipient. Each word was an effort. All the while I kept an eye on Michael, who had gathered his belongings and was making his way over to the gate where I sat, the wrong gate, it turned out, unless we were planning to go to Kansas City. Oh, Danny. Well, I'm absolutely sure of one thing, Charlotte finally said before we got off the phone. Your father is still your father. It had been 11, maybe 12 hours since Michael sat next to me in my office, a sequence of numbers unlocking the combination to a me I hadn't known. In those hours, I had felt sorrow, despair, alienation, numbness, shock, confusion, mostly confusion. And also something else. I was on the hunt. A fact-finding mission had taken me over, keeping the deeper reservoir of feelings at bay. Your father is still your father. It was a loving thing to say, meant to console, but I didn't know what it could possibly mean that my father was still my father. I was at the beginning of a journey, one that I would walk alone, step by treacherous step. It felt like a truism, a cliché, a salve. I loved my father with all my heart and had devoted much of my life to him. But, in purely clinical terms, he wasn't my father. There was someone out there, some anonymous man, possibly alive, probably dead, maybe a sperm donor who had once been a medical student at the University of Pennsylvania, who technically, biologically, was my father. A point of fact. Michael and I stepped onto the moving walkway. Still, quiet, pensive, we glided through the airport. People, people everywhere. Fellow travelers. An elderly couple moved in the opposite direction. A white-haired man, mid-80s, wearing a raincoat. I smiled at him and looked swiftly away. 54 was definitely not too old for a surprise. At 54, with any luck, I had a few decades left to live. Would I ever know about that somebody else? Would I ever again feel that my father was my father? Would it always matter? Lines from a Delmore Schwartz poem come to mind. What am I now that I was then? May memory restore again and again the smallest color of the smallest day. Time is the school in which we learn. Time is the fire in which we burn. Chapter 10. I tell my students, who are concerned with the question of betrayal, that when it comes to memoir, there is no such thing as absolute truth, only the truth that is singularly their own. I say this not to release them from responsibility, but to illuminate the subjectivity of our inner lives. One person's experience is not another's. If five people in a family were to write the story of that family, we would end up with five very different stories. These are truths of a sort, the truth of adhering to what one remembers. Then there are facts which are by their nature documentable. The weather on a particular day can be ascertained, as can the date of the explosion. Perhaps there is a photograph of the dress she was wearing, and so forth. But the intentions of your father, the inner life of your mother, at these we can only hazard our best guess. Students sometimes tell me they're waiting for someone to die before they feel they can write their story. They say this sheepishly, guiltily, as if in some way they're wishing for that person to expire already so they can get on with the business of writing about them. I try to liberate my students from these tortured thoughts by telling them that they may as well just start now, because it can be more difficult to write about the dead than to write about the living. The dead can't fight back. The dead have no voice. They can't say, "But that isn't how it was. You're getting it wrong." They can't say, "But I loved you so." They can't say, "I had no idea." And so each day, when I sit down to write, I am wrestling not only with my dead parents, but with a dearth of documentable facts. A friend offers to set me up with a world-famous medium the FBI frequently uses as a resource in solving complex cases. "She'll be able to tell you what your father knew," she says. "But I can't call the medium, at least not now. Not only because I'm skeptical, but because I need to arrive at my own beliefs about myself and my parents and the world we inhabited. I need to understand who I was to them and who they were to me. In the absence of the empirical, I am left with a feeling central to my childhood. All my life I had the sense that something was amiss, that I was different, an outsider. My family